Testing. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2.
There's a fabulous story doing the rounds online this week about the town of McAllen. It's in the south of Texas, and the departure of a Walmart left over 124,000 square feet of retail space vacant. In its place, the city decided to repurpose the building as its new public library. It is now the largest single-story library in the United States, and within its sizable grounds are a market garden and a pizza shop that looks pretty swish online. It's picked up a swathe of design awards. It looks utterly beautiful. We'll put some links up on the Blueprint for Living website. It is an example of a practice in architecture known as adaptive reuse. And to help us better understand it, I'm joined by architect Stuart Harrison of Harrison and White in Melbourne. Stuart, is this just recycling with a fancy knobby name on top?
Well, Michael, in some ways it's a sort of different take on recycling. It's sort of become really more popular as an idea in recent years. And the example you just cited is consistent with that. I guess it's really about going, you know, in a very energy sensitive future. How do we not use the enormous amount of energy that's required in producing a new building, along with all the traditional benefits of reuse or heritage, which is to do with, you know, the character and authenticity of an existing building. So this idea is a form of recycling, but it's really become popular again in the last decade or so, I think, under the banner, the bigger banner of sustainability, essentially.
So I'm interested in that, the sustainability and energy thing, because surely we've learnt so much in the way we build buildings that it's not a given that for energy efficiency, for all kinds of different codes and practices that we've developed over the years, it's a good idea to stick with something old.
Yes, it is. But the reality of building projects is they're in massively complex when they're new, and they're even more complex when you're actually adapting old structures as well. So the energy level goes down in terms of overall energy, embodied energy, to create an adaptive reuse project, but the complexity, in a way, and some of the costs involved can actually go up. So at a certain point in the future where energy becomes so expensive, that'll make the equation easier. But right now, adaptive reuse is often sometimes more expensive anyway than knocking something down. And certainly, you know, if you've got a whole lot of consultants who are going, oh, it's just a lot easier to do something new. There's pressures either way to either do adaptive reuse or not. Sometimes you have to, in a way, because of heritage listing. The interesting parts are where you don't have to necessarily keep a building, and your client group or the developer or whoever is making the decisions chooses to retain the existing building.
So on that kind of heritage front, how much of it is about a certain kind of nostalgia as our cities change, trying to make sure that we hang on to some kind of quintessential qualities?
I think for nostalgia you could substitute placemaking, you know, an identity that. One of the key things that, you know, crisis you have in creating new places, and you might see this in places like, say, Melbourne Docklands, for example, is when you begin to erase almost everything, you lose a sense of place. And almost everything has a prior condition, whether that's, pre-European settlement condition, you know, or a pre-industrial condition or post-industrial condition. So how do you bring that quality of the past? And often by retaining existing buildings or infrastructure, it's not just buildings, can really give you a long way to establishing a sense of place and an authenticity that comes with that. And so the new thing is kind of a building on the old thing, not a tabula rasa.
Do you have particular favourites internationally of this kind of adaptive reuse?
Well, probably the most famous sort of landscape architecture project of the last 10 years is the High Line Park in New York.
I was hoping you'd mention it so I wouldn't have to look like a poser, but I love the High Line in New York.
Everyone loves the High Line, and for good reason. I mean, and for listeners who don't know, it's an old elevated train track, goods trains track in New York that was abandoned decades ago, and then a community-led project led to its eventual revitalisation as an elevated park. It's a fantastic project because it builds on the history of the structure, which is essentially elevated train line, and builds on actually what it had already become, which was that it had sort of began to seed and grow up there anyway. So it sort of wanted to become this park, and then they got a good landscape architect to come in, and now it's an incredibly successful project. And New Yorkers now talk about it as their primary public space, almost, you know, over Times Square.
The other thing is, if listeners want to go and walk, they're almost guaranteed to run into Australians walking the High Line. For some reason, it strikes a chord.
Yes, well, I think it's hanging outside.
Yeah, that's
right. It is a beautiful project, and it just shows you the value of not just buildings, but, you know, infrastructure as well. And in fact, industrial buildings and infrastructure are probably some of the best ones. In Sydney, for example, the Carriage Works project has been an incredibly successful rework of train, you know, manufacturing yards into all kinds of cultural programs. And the other really great one, I think, internationally, is the Palais de Tokyo in Paris, the gallery. which took a big sort of trade pavilion built for one of those big expositions, which was derelict for years, and turned it into a gallery where there's a great fit between contemporary art and the sort of roughness of the space. So in there, they really didn't do much refurbishment.
It always seems to me to have a kind of note of melancholy about it, or often does, that this is kind of urban decay somehow picked up and revitalized. You know, do you think it has something to do with the way cities and industry are changing?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, the adaptive reuse projects of Western society are the former industrial sites. So they're a post-industrial phenomenon, and you'll see lots of them emerging in Detroit and other cities where, you know, and lots of factories that used to be, used to make things are now used for other things. So in some ways, it's an indication of how society has moved. But it's about, you know, how do you intelligently use things? I mean, I think it's really important to point out that one of these things that you have to do is kind of, if you want to reuse a building, is make it compliant and all those sort of regulatory things. And so that, to some extent, forces creative solutions for how you reuse projects.
So earlier this week, you got to an example here in Melbourne.
Yes.
You went to the old Channel 9 studios in the Melbourne suburb of Richmond.
I did indeed, which has had several, three lives, in fact, and this is its fourth use. It's now been converted to residential, which is probably one of the mainstays of adaptive reuse, is converting factories to living.
We'll listen to you talking to the architect there. That's Kirsten Thompson.
So, Kirsten, it's a lovely sunny day. We're standing in the central courtyard of the Wertheim Factory project, which is part of Studio 9, and we're talking about adaptive reuse, and this has really had three adaptive reuses. Mm. It started as a piano factory.
It did in 1909, started as the Wertheim Piano Factory and then evolved into the Heinz Factory, I think, for canning in the 30s. And then most recently, and probably the most familiar for our generation, as GTV 9, home of Hey Hey, It's Saturday and everything else.
Looking back at the history of the site, did you choose to engage more with that original use of the piano factory?
Look, we thought that it's important not to just pull out one part of this site's history. There's many histories, and we thought that there was lots of value in working with that. So, for example, the entertainment history, the industrial history as a place of manufacturing, they're all things we drew upon in the design, whether it's internal lights that have a sense of studio lighting, or whether it's the black and white theme to the interiors, which draws on the piano, or the use of metal for canning. So ways to suggest what was here before and how that might keep informing the project.
So it really is a fairly material-based strategy, and standing here in the courtyard we can see overwhelmingly a lot of red brick from the original factory, and we can also see very clearly the new elements that are primarily metal and very easy to distinguish. And I think with the new elements you see here, it seems to me a strategy of layering. The mesh is a very layered system. It has a degree of transparency. You can see through to a new stair. And also we're looking at exactly a grid structure of galvanised steel with a mesh on it. That obviously does a couple of things, supports balconies and encourages greenery.
That's right, exactly. And that just makes a little bit of a privacy threshold, if you like, between those dwellings and this central courtyard, which is actually a public space. So anyone can walk through this in the neighbourhood. This can be part of the shortcuts through this part of the suburb. And you're right about the layering, certainly the use of something like a metal mesh, which is almost like a veil, it looks like a material, is a good contrast to the thickness and the heaviness and the weight that you've got of the original red bricks. So yes, a clear distinction between what's new and what was existing.
Well, let's go inside. Okay, well, we are standing now really in the entranceway. It is a naturally ventilated space. It's a lift lobby and staircase, and really you get a sense of both new and existing materials playing themselves out here, Kirsten.
That's right. So in these common areas, we were very keen to have a fresh sense of air and really work as a breezeway, so you can even feel that breeze slightly standing here rather than that stuffy internal corridor feeling. And you can see too that where the apartments and internally are pretty white, crisp, plasterboard lined. By contrast, in these areas, we've been able to leave a lot of the brickwork exposed, and where you get a real sense of the different layers of the building's fabric. So a bit of render here, the steel stairs and the mesh as well. And then you can see on the floor a little sign of the old piano factory, that the actual numbers for an address for each of the apartments is actually a big black stripe on the floor with giant sort of super graphic numbers. So your piano keys, if you like.
Stuart, I'm going to call on you in a minute to find out what you really think about the job they did without the architect standing beside you. But we are joined in the studio now by one of the residents of those apartments. Anita Clark, tell us, what drew you to live in a building that's probably haunted by Daryl Summers?
That was part of it. I was downsizing from a big family home to an apartment, and certainly location was obviously a very important part of where I was going to choose. But I did love also the fact that these apartments were very individual, and certainly the heritage apartment that I purchased, I think, is one that nobody else will have a similar apartment to. And so that was the first thing. And then when I did go down and spend a bit of time in that part of Richmond, I really loved all of the surrounding areas with a lot of parklands and proximity to the river.
I think that's a really interesting thing, Anita, because and this came out of talking to Kirsten Thompson, the architect, is that because the structure was quite complex, all the apartments ended up being slightly different, and so they all do have a real sort of individuality about them. And it's probably also worth pointing out that the bigger development there is, a lot of it is new dwellings, and these are really the bit of the heritage elements that set up the whole rest of the, and give an identity to the whole wider development. So in some ways the new build stuff is borrowing some authenticity from the old stuff. But I wanted to ask about that central courtyard and how that gets used and how you use it, because it's actually a fully public space.
Yeah, it is a public space, and it's now got a cafe that was opened there, which I think was a great idea, and that has attracted obviously a lot of people who don't live in the area as well to use that part. There is a barbecue as well that you can organise with the manager there if you want to have people round for a barbecue. I'm fairly lucky in that I've got quite a big outdoor area of my own, so I don't use the central courtyard perhaps as much as some of the other tenants do.
I wanted to ask about also, sorry, Mike, the outdoor space of your own. How important is that? Like, do you eat outside a lot? And
yeah, I do. And I've got two dogs, which was also a big factor with moving into an apartment, that I wanted to have somewhere where they had an outdoor area. And that's quite rare, particularly in inner city Melbourne. You usually just have to have your dogs on a balcony, which isn't great when you work full time.
I want to ask, I don't want to be the voice of negativity here, but are there cons to living in the kind of repurposed old building?
Oh, look, mine is two-storey, and so the 4.5-metre ceilings downstairs mean 27 stairs upstairs, which can sometimes be a bit annoying if you leave your phone upstairs like I always seem to. So that's probably one of the cons. And look, I am definitely getting used to living within an apartment complex and body corporates and those sorts of things, which is a new experience for me. But look, that's probably the only con. I'm very happy.
No echoes of its former tenants?
I'm actually in the part that was Kerry Packer's office, and so sometimes I get a little bit of an echo as I go to the chocolate and think, yeah. I'll get
possibly diabetes. Not radio, possibly not radio-friendly language echoing through that wing of the building.
That con about the ceiling heights, obviously the pro side of that is that you get a 4.5-metre ceiling, which is pretty extraordinary in an apartment building, which normally are pushing down to 2.4 metres.
Exactly, so. And I've got beautiful, you know, ceiling height windows, so I've got great light and it's facing the north, so that's a big plus as well.
That sounds like then getting Sam Newman's mail would be a small price to pay. Anita Clark and Stuart Harrison, thank you both so much for coming into Blueprint for Living this morning.